The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning I'd like to talk a little bit about a discourse that the Buddha gave that is called the Fire Sermon. It's said to be the third talk that he gave after his awakening. And often the first three are kind of packaged together as being quite significant. And this fire sermon was a sermon that was given to a group of newly ordained monks, a group of people who are ordained together, who had been fire worshippers. Back in ancient India, they did a lot of fire worship, and that was their primary religious activity. And in giving a teaching to them, he gave a teaching called the Fire Sermon, appropriately. Now, to get into this Fire Sermon, I think it's helpful to realize that in Buddhism, in the Buddhist teachings, often a contrast or dichotomy that's offered between suffering and being liberated from suffering, between being tormented by suffering and being relieved of it. And so the image of the fire is one that's often used for the part of the torments, for the struggles, the afflictions, the difficulties of life that we have. And the contrast is that of, oppressive heat, the contrast to that is refreshing coolness. And those of you who have lived in very hot climates, maybe you could appreciate how nice and important coolness is. For refreshment, for nourishment, for relief, whatever. And people who, you know, they say that the English language, because it came out of cold and damp and rainy England, what's championed in the language is a lot of words of warmth. A person who's really warm-hearted is a really wonderful person. In really hot climates, someone who's cool-hearted is someone who's, you know, valued a lot. Whereas, you know, we say someone's cold and, you know, that's not, it's not a good thing. But, you know, the metaphors of a society have a lot to do with, you know, where the language was developed. And so Buddhism, the language and the metaphors of Buddhism arose out of a very hot climate of India. And so coolness was very highly valued. And so one of the synonyms for nirvana, for nibbana, liberation, is coolness, becoming cooled. And if you know, if you're English, that doesn't mean much. But if you're from Phoenix, then perhaps, you know, I read the other day it was 108 in Phoenix, right? Right? So being cool is good. So the contrast here is between fire and coolness, and the oppressive heat and the refreshing coolness. And the Buddha begins the sermon by saying, "Everything is on fire." It's a pretty rhetorically, pretty dramatic way of starting. I read I saw in a book of the 100 or whatever greatest speeches of all times. And this sermon of the Buddha was in that book, the Fire Sermon. And it's kind of has this wonderful rhetoric in it, approach. Kind of, so it starts off, everything's on fire. And perhaps I shouldn't say it in a mild way. I should say it, you know, everything is burning. And then you have your attention. Everything is burning, 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 burning. Some of you know T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland. You know it, some of you? The third section of that is called The Fire Sermon. And it's taken from the title of this sermon, the Buddha. And he wrote it right after World War I. And there's so much devastation in Europe, especially England. So many people died. I was actually quite moved this last couple of weeks, reading about the two English soldiers who died. One was 111 and one was 113. And they're the last living connections, apparently, of English people who went through the what's called the trenches. And, you know, horrendous brutality and destruction and war. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people dying in single battles. And the stupid way of fighting wars. All, like, they're all stupid. And so right after that, you know, World War I, he's writing The Wastelands. And the third section of this poem is called The Fire Sermon. And that section of the poem ends, it's burning, 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 burning. And so I was moved by these, you know, World War I stories this last couple of weeks. And I grew up, you know, I've had a very fortunate life, feels to me, many ways. One was I've never been through a war. And it's, I feel like it's quite unusual for many people in the last centuries to not to go through a war. Probably many of you have not gone through a war. Some of you have. But I grew up with it all around me. I grew up in Europe quite a bit. I'm Norwegian. And my parents went through war. They went through occupation, the occupation of Norway. My grandfather had things that he didn't want to talk about. He was in the resistance in Norway, and he saw things and was arrested and jailed. And my friends of my family growing up, you know, growing up in Italy partly, it was common to hear stories of people who had been through the war in all kinds of ways. And, you know, there were times I heard stories from people who had been as soldiers who had killed people. And what do you say to them? They tell you their story of how they killed someone. What do you say? How do you respond? One man I knew was captured by the Japanese in Indonesia and was held in Japanese prison camps in Indonesia, treated quite brutally. And then he was released. At the end of the war, the Japanese surrendered, and so he was released. And they were shipping all the Japanese soldiers back to Japan. And he was a free man, and he walked down to the docks where they were being shipped back. And there was one particular soldier in the prison camps who was really brutal. You know, maybe killed people, tortured people, brutal people. Him and his friends came along and tied him up and threw him into the water. What do you say? He tells me the story. What do you say? So I grew up with this all around me. And it's for me, there's a contrast. One of the themes of the day is a contrast between the life of, you know, of how I've lived my life in very fortunate circumstances, and then being so aware of so much suffering, so much pain, so much war and distress in so many different ways kind of reaching out into our society and our world. You know, I'm old enough, I grew up with the Vietnam War, some of you are as well. And that was quite a big impact on me, and war after war after war. It never happened here, so close though. I remember being in L.A. and watching L.A. burning. I think it was 1964, 63. The Watts riots, and we kind of lived in kind of in hilly areas. We could look down and see L.A. burning, 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 and the Rodney King riots. One day in retreat, I was teaching a retreat, and this woman came to me, and what she wanted to talk about in the retreat was her father had been somehow in the wrong place at the wrong time during the Rodney King riots, and now was basically kind of in a semi-vegetative state. And burning, 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 and then at the Iraq War started, the first one started, walking through San Francisco and seeing store windows broken and trash cans on fire, relatively mild, but still burning. The prison system in California, United States, the place of fire, burning, burning, all these people burning. It's quite dramatic. The United States has such a huge prison population. Such as California has a huge, biggest recidivism rate in the country. And if anything has failed, There's a California prison system. So it's easy to see these things. And there's a lot of them. And so some of us live in comfort and don't see it on a daily basis. It's something we read about in the paper or something we encounter, you know, far away. And some of us live right in the middle of it in our own communities, where in our own families, where there's fire, there's burning with rage and burning with greed and burning with lust and burning with all kinds of things. And so this, everything is burning. And then there's a very interesting movement that happens, and a very important movement is, you know, how we relate to all this strife and burning and difficulty. And at some point, when we see it objectively in the world, at some point, our subjective experience becomes prominent. At some point, you would get so distressed, perhaps, like some of you are distressed that I brought it up today. And we feel kind of troubled by it in some way, or frightened by it, or upset by it, or something. Or perhaps we're the one who's burning, and we're filled with rage or hate, we're filled with lust or greed in such a way that we're on fire. And at some point, the object, the lust, the object of the hate, becomes less important than the way it feels for us, the subjective experience of how difficult it is for us. And that's a very important turning, when we turn away from the object of our concern, object of focus, to become aware of what's actually going on for us here. And sometimes it's because the world is so distressed, so difficult, that at some point we can't, and we feel our reaction is so strong, at some point we can't ignore it anymore. Some people, in feeling their own distress, then will lash out even more, will focus even more externally, want that person, get rid of that person, fix up what's out there. But at some point there's a turning inward and say, well, gee, I need to look at this here. I need to look at what's happening here with me. And some people see that they're burning. And I've been on fire. I've been in fire with the fires of lust and hate, and it feels awful to be kind of lose my freedom and to kind of being driven by these inner forces that are so powerful. And so what happens when we turn inward to the subjective side of it all? And that is where the Buddha pointed to. So when these monks of his who had been fire worshippers came to hear him teach, and he said, everything is burning. He then did, that gets their attention perhaps, and then he turned it around immediately. And he turned it around to the subjective world. And perhaps the fire people being fire worshippers are focusing on the external world, something out there. The fire gods are going to fix things. If you sacrifice in the fire to the fire gods will provide bounty, boons, will support us. And the Buddha over and over again turned away from the external ritualization that happened much in India of his time as being the place of spiritual life, and focused back into the subjective world here. So when people were focusing on bathing in the Ganges back then, time of the Buddha, in order to become ritually pure, the Buddha said, oh, that's not how you become ritually pure. The way you become ritually pure is through your own ethical behavior, your own virtue. That's what purifies you. So again, turning in subjectively to how you are. Animal sacrifice. Oh, he'd say, oh, much better than sacrificing animals is to practice generosity. Be generous and kind of sacrifice your own possessions and support other people. Much better than worshiping, there was people apparently back then who worshiped the four directions, the north, south, west, and all that, the different directions. And he said, oh, much better than that. He said, oh, the way you really do it, he said, the way you really worship the four directions is I forget exactly how it goes, but the western direction is your family, and you take good care of them. The southern direction is your teachers, you take good care of them. The eastern direction is, you know, the different people. And so he kind of turned it around and said, oh, it's really how you engage with the world, how you support it and how you help. So when talking to these ex-fire monks, the Buddha said, oh, everything is burning. And then what is burning? This is what he said. Everything is burning. And how is everything burning? The eye is burning. What we see through the eyes is burning. Or it says more clearly, it says here, the mental impressions that come with the eye are burning. Contact of the eye with visible things is burning. The sensation produced by the contact of the eye with visible things is burning. With what is it burning? I declare unto you that it is burning with the fire of greed, with the fire of anger, and the fire of ignorance. It is burning with the anxieties of birth, decay, death, grief, lamentation, suffering, dejection, and despair. So the world is not burning. Everything, when the Buddha says everything, he does not mean the world. You think, oh, everything is everything. Over and over again, when the Buddha used the word everything, he limited it to how we experience everything. And there's a huge difference between the world and what our experience of the world is. So if we, and this is a very, maybe seems like a subtle a difference, but in Buddhism it's very, very important. There's the book I'm holding, and there's the experience I have of the book. And the book is one thing, but my experience of it might be colored by my desire for the book, by my pride around the book since I was involved with it somehow, by all kinds of subjective attitudes I have towards this book. So I see the book, and part of the subjective experience is part of my experience of the book. So, and when I see the book, I see the book, experience it a lot through the apparatus of my own particular sense doors. If I was a dog, I'd be colorblind, right? I wouldn't see it as blue, but I see it as the cover as blue. The subjective way we experience things is very impactful for what goes on. Buddhism doesn't make much claim about the nature of the world as being good or bad. Doesn't affirm the world or reject the world. The world is what it is. The focus of Buddhism is how we relate to this world as it is. That's the real place where liberation can happen, where freedom can happen. And that's where we get bound up in creating our suffering. Suffering, you know, the conditions of the world are what they are. Sometimes very difficult to be with, sometimes easy to be with. The conditions of the world are what they are. Our suffering based on those conditions comes from how we relate to it, the subjective world. So the Buddha is turning here to the monks saying, go back and look at how you perceive, how you experience. And here he starts with the eyes. How we can experience with the world with the eyes can be burning if it's burning with greed, hate, and delusion. And then he goes through in a kind of the rhetorical way, the ears are on fire. And how we see, how we hear is on fire with the fire of greed, hate, and delusion, anxiety. The nose is on fire. The taste is on fire. The body is on fire. And the mind is on fire with these things. And he goes on and on, you know, and if you appreciate kind of repetitive ways of giving sermons, they work best if you talk in a very dramatic way, in a way that I can't. You kind of hammer it in, you know. The air is burning. The tongue is burning. The body is burning. Considering this, a person who walks the noble path becomes disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with visible things, disenchanted with mental impressions based in the eye, disenchanted with contact of the eye with visible things, disenchanted with the sensations produced by contact with the eye with visible things. Becomes disenchanted is a very important word. Disenchanted means we no longer are under this idea, this magical idea, or spell that somehow the things that we experience in the world, whether they be things or people or ideas or whatever it might be, that somehow magically they're going to provide us with lasting peace and happiness and well-being. That if we can just manipulate the conditions of the world enough, that then everything will be fine, we'll be happy ever after. Buddhism, Buddha over and over again is saying, if you really want lasting happiness and peace, you don't find it by manipulating the world and your family and your people and get everything just set right. You don't even do it by manipulating your health. But you find it by how you relate to this world. And if you relate to it through this magical thinking that it's going to provide you with lasting happiness, you're putting your eggs in the wrong basket. And so there's a very important step in this subjective experience of Buddhism, is turning into the subjective world, where the subjective world is no longer reaching out of itself, grasping and holding on and wanting and enchanted and has magic. And this is very helpful with the practice of meditation, where meditation is this training not to have the mind go out or grab on or stay connected or stay attached, stay driven, stay burning. And slowly we learn to let go, we learn to calm and relax, we learn to cool down. So the experience of the mind and the heart is one that is not driven, is not burning, is not caught, is not engaged. So one becomes disenchanted of all that. And by disenchanting, and by becoming disenchanted, one divests oneself of grasping. And by the absence of grasping, one is made free. When one is free, one becomes aware that one is free. And when this exposition was propounded, the minds of the monks became free from attachments to the world and were released from all entanglements. It doesn't say that here, but their hearts became cool. So, is your world burning? And what's your experience of becoming cool? So this dichotomy between the problem and the solution. The problem being, if there is a problem for you, is here is defined as being fire. And the solution, is the good news, is that there is extinguishing of the fire. There is a coolness that can happen. And having grown up in an English-speaking language, it's not that impactful for me, this idea of coolness. But the idea of peace is. And there's coolness and peace, I think, maybe are synonymous. And I think one of the beautiful things, very profound things, very meaningful things that I've experienced through this, my practice, Buddhist practice, is having discovered or touched delightful possibilities of peace, delightful possibilities of having quenched or cooled the fires that have driven me. And what I find is that as these fires within me have quieted down, gotten cooled, that I have a very different relationship with the external world. We're a very different relationship with the wars that we have all around us, with the suffering and the difficulties that seem such a big part of this human life of ours. We don't want to deny that it's there. We don't want to pretty it over. But to be able to meet it and encounter it and be helpful in this world with a heart and a mind which is not on fire, which is not with anxiety or greed or anger or distress, but be able to meet it with our peacefulness, our coolness, and to offer our cooling effect on the world. The Buddha's path is a public path. And a public path means that how we are changed and transformed by it is not just something that affects us, but also it supports and helps other people as well. It's hopefully we can all cool down together. That's why I turned off the air conditioner earlier. So we could do it. So that's my fire and brimstone talk. So now is your turn. If you have any comments about that or questions or whatever you'd like to say in response to the talk, please.
I had two kind of comments or question. One is that I noticed that the intense burning of fire, isn't that different than the, you think you're cultivating, or I think I'm cultivating disenchantment. Like maybe I'm not hung up on something. But there's sort of a low level of distraction. And then when something comes along that makes me really greedy or desirous, I think to myself, this isn't so, I mean, the subject is maybe more, I'm more focused on one subject, but I'll be kind of distracted, just as distracted when I'm not full of greed or desire. And I'm kind of wondering, what is it like to cultivate? Do you cultivate disenchantment, or is disenchantment something that just happens?
So to answer that last question, some people will cultivate it, and hopefully it's cultivated out of wisdom. I mean, the last thing you want, I don't have a lot of trust in simply learning an idea and thinking, that's a good idea, and then I'll try to fit myself into that idea, and now I'm going to go around being disenchanted. But if there's a real seeing, a real understanding, that I've been burned enough times by this. Okay, I know now. So I think it's useful to become disenchanted with it and no longer be pulled into that world, and be remind myself how often I got burned by it. And that kind of cultivation, I think, is maybe useful. It's a wise way of living. Some of the disenchantment just comes with time as we practice. As we practice, we become more sensitive. As we become more sensitive, we become naturally more aware of the impact and the cost of how we're living and the enchantment we have. And as we're aware of the cost, we tend to become, I think, naturally more disenchanted. So I like very much kind of the more natural approach to practice. You practice, the practice, opens our eyes and we see more clearly, and then we change as a result of that. You talked about your low-grade distracted mind, and there are times when you're filled with greed, hate, and that's recognizable, but it seems like this low-grade kind of distractibility.
It's like embers or something.
Yeah. Maybe they're embers. because if you sit down to, one of the great tests, I think, is sitting down to meditate. Because you sit down to meditate, and it's a wonderful time to kind of find out what's actually going on in your mind. And because I've been in situations where I thought, I'm doing just fine, thank you. And then I sit down to meditate, I'm really, certainly caught by those subtle ideas and thoughts. And there's certain unresolved things going on for me. And I wouldn't have known it until I sat down to meditate. So the low-grade distractibility is a symptom that something is still unresolved for you and someplace you're not free.
When the Buddha spoke, I think it would be safe to say it was more of an agrarian culture. But in today's urban information overload age, it seems like our distractions are a thousandfold greater than what I find in these agrarian cultures. Is that more of a challenge for us to cool us down, or is there any hope for us in this jam-packed urban world?
No. If your subjective world is jam-packed and urban, there's no hope for you. Your subjective world has to stop being jam-packed. Somehow you have to. It doesn't mean that you have to necessarily get rid of all your cell phones and computer electronics and everything. But unless there's some change in how you live your life, if you try to do everything and have every possible gadget and thing, and it's just you know, probably there's no hope for you. Good luck. You have more you want to ask?
Understand.
So, you understand?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
About the British soldiers who died recently. I really liked reading about one of them who was so bothered by World War I that he couldn't share his impressions about it with anyone until he turned 100 years old 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And then he could finally say, it wasn't worth it.
Yeah. I'm really struck by how long the effects of war last. And, you know, hundreds of years, you know. There was also President Obama is going to, or ordered the Presidential Medal of Honor to a whole bunch of people. It's going to, you know, this. And one of the people is the last living Plains Indian, maybe Sioux, I don't know what, Plains Indian war, chief. I guess the last one. But what really struck me was not so much he's the last living one of this particular tribe, I guess, whatever, but rather he's the last person alive who interviewed someone who was in the Battle of Bighorn, 1876. So they're kind of, again, it's a living connection to history, and you know how these still affect people, and you know, people are affected by war. The African Americans in America affected by the experience of slavery. You know, slavery ended over 140 years ago. It's still a big impact, generation after generation, how these things affect each other. So so the war in Iraq, you know, it's going to be alive and relevant for people 100 years from now. Here in this country and elsewhere, and when we go into war, it's not just the war of this particular year. It's creating conditions for 100 years, and how we live our lives today are meaningful not just for this day, but are meaningful for well into the future, for not just ourselves but for other people as well. So, you know, part of what's behind this kind of, in my thinking about this talk today, was that my own very strong motivation to engage in Buddhist practice is because I see the world burning, and I would like to be able to meet it and help the world suffer less. And, you know, that's really what's driven me to become a teacher, is to really try to make a difference in this world. And it would be nice to believe that those of us, you know, who try to make a difference, improve the world, that also can have a 100-year effect. It's not just war that has 100 years effect. Maybe IMC will be standing here in 100 years. Yes, please. Can you wait for the mic?
I drove here this morning, and I parked on the street around the corner there. And as I pulled into the parking spot, I kind of noticed a fellow leaving that large building on the corner. And I kind of thought, well, it must be a deliberate guy. He made it deliberate, and he's coming back out. So I unbuckled myself, and I was kind of fussing with the car. And the guy started walking across or coming down to the street, and I noticed, no, he's got a suit on and he's pushing a gurney. And I noticed there was a blue blanket on the gurney. And as he crossed in front of me, I could see a human profile in that blue blanket. And it struck me how mundane what I was seeing. There was this one fellow pushing one gurney with basically a corpse on the gurney, somebody that died in the corner house there. And I guess what I got to see was there was no ceremony or fanfare. This was bringing out something, and he was putting it in a white van. They were going to take it away. And I could put the drama to it and say how sad, but I think through practice, I just noticed this was a natural cycle and occurrence of life, and here's a conditioned person who's no longer there, and anything that went on has already happened, and it was very natural for this to take place. I was, again, struck by how mundane this truly was to notice this body being taken out, put into a van, and driven away. That's it. That's the story, kind of in light of it's burning and the conditioning of the senses and the aggregates. So, thanks.
With regard to burning and lasting effects, how does guilt play into this? I mean, it can last a long time. Is there a purpose?
To guilt?
Yeah, it can really burn.
That's one of the purposes. I guess, I suppose one purpose of guilt, I mean, a useful purpose would be to prevent us from doing that again. If we did something that caused harm, guilt can be preventive.
But is there an unwholesome guilt?
In Buddhist psychology, the way Buddhists use language, guilt is always unwholesome. It's always an unnecessary and unuseful, well, unnecessary. I mean, it has usefulness, but it's considered an unnecessary emotion because some of the ways in which we can learn from our mistakes don't require guilt. So we have other words in Buddhism, like some people like the word remorse or regret. Guilt has the quality of kind of self-hate, at least in Buddhist psychology. So there's a kind of a self-hate or self-criticism as part of it, and that's not useful. But to feel some kind of healthy remorse so we do better in the future and so we make amends for the harm that we caused is a very important quality for human beings. And so to learn to distinguish between that and to be caught and stuck in guilt means that we're really attached to something. And we're probably attached to something to do around self. Guilt has very much to do with self-identification, self-ideas. So to understand, how am I holding myself? What's the grasping to self, self-image, self-identity that I have here? And sometimes this idea that the attachments to self are something that's inherited almost from the way we're brought up. Sometimes guilt is inculcated by, you know, almost like by mother's milk. And it takes a while to learn to be free of it. Does that make sense? But in part, to become free of it helps become free yourself of this yoke of self-idea, self-focused idea. But as we free ourselves from this yoke of self-centeredness, the healthy version of that is if we do something that causes harm, the heart feels remorse, the heart feels regret. And it's if you didn't, I would worry about you. So, thank you. And after last week's talk, Steve Gassner said that was a good beginning. So that's why I thought I would give this fire and brimstone talk. And hopefully it was useful to hear it, and hopefully useful to hear the side of what the Buddha had to teach, the fire sermon. And if you want to get it from a different angle, go read The Wasteland. So thank you all.